Trail, a podcast that's about inspiring you with fascinating and thoughtful stories and interviews from our trail community. I hope that by listening to the show, you get ideas, tips, and inspiration to experience the trail in different ways and excited to get outdoors and immersed in nature. If you love the outdoors and spending time on the trails, then hit that subscribe button so you don't miss the episodes as they land fortnightly. Today, I'm speaking with Dave Thomas. Dave is the former CEO and now chair of a three-location gym chain in London called The Foundry. Wanting to step away from busy London life, Dave took the leap and took custody of a 300-acre upland eco-farm that sits on the Dales Way. With a love for long-distance hiking and a history of head injury, Dave combined his passions of fitness, entrepreneurship, and his desire to make the world a better place and set off on a walk across Britain with the support of his wife, and four-year-old to raise money for Headway UK. I hope you enjoy the show.
I have been a fitness professional for at least 15 years. I've set up and founded and run a few gym companies, all under the brand of The Foundry, all based in London. I've sort of stepped away a little bit from that now, away from the management side of things. I'm still a very proud shareholder of the business, and I suppose for a lot of people, kind of living the dream now, having built something up and kind of let it fly a little bit. But to be honest, as well, just got to the stage I am, kind of looking at the next stage now. I think. A slightly better work-life balance. I'm a dad to two wonderful kids, Willow, who's 4.5, Ash, who's 2.5, husband to a long-suffering wife, Helen, very proud Yorkshireman, yeah, who's basically been exiled in London for nearly 20 years now, so looking to move back permanently fairly soon. So that's kind of my main thing. It's been in the fitness industry, but I'm one of those people. I tend to get quite itchy feet. Obviously, it's probably the appeal of hiking, especially through hiking. But also, just career wise, I mean, I've done basically everything. When I first moved to London, I was actually running conferences, which was quite handy because it gave me a pretty good all round sort of background in, marketing, sales, commerce, everything. And I just realized one day, though, I was getting a little bit podgy around the middle, a little bit miserable, sat at my desk all day, drinking 8 pints every night. I'd been a sportsman before that. Rugby was my sort of primary game. And I just realized I wanted to make a change. And one day I was working out with a mate of mine at the YMCA, Central YMCA in the middle of London. And I saw this chap, and he must have been in his 50s, and he was working out with somebody else. And clearly there was a different relationship than just a gym buddy going on, but I didn't know what it was. And so afterwards, I just went up to him and asked what the situation was. He said, I'm a personal trainer. And I genuinely didn't know what that was. I'd never heard of it. I mean, this is like early 2000s, and you probably know him. Are you born and bred sort of Peak District way, Matthew?
No, no. Hard to place accent, London originally.
Are you London originally? So, you were probably tripping over personal trainers even when you were young, but they definitely weren't around Doncaster. I don't think I'd ever heard of a personal trainer. So I was genuinely sort of bemused and fascinated, and I just couldn't get my head around the fact you could sort of work with people in a gym and help them get fit and healthy and spend all day in the gym and get paid for it. So I literally handed in my notice about 2 days later, and became a personal trainer, and that's sort of where it all just sort of rolled on from there, really.
Amazing. So from PT, you then developed a gym. What I'm assuming launched a gym. How?
Yeah. So it was actually originally
curious
it was me and
to
my
know your timeline.
Yeah. So originally I was. I mean, this is in my early 20s. you know, you're pretty naive, but we're also broke. So the idea of sort of global, you know, sort of building an empire wasn't really on the cards then. But so I started out as a kind of a, what you'd call a mobile personal trainer. I was just traveling around nice houses in West London, training people in their living rooms and so on. And but I was absolutely knackered. You know, I was probably doing 30 to 40 hours of training a week with people. But obviously then when you threw the travel into that as well, you could basically double that. And so I realized that I needed a location. And so after sort of, you know, building up this client base after a couple of years, my wife was made redundant because she was just in the financial crash. And she, so yeah, she was in the unfortunate position of being kind of last one in the door, first one out, unfortunately, of a job she'd only just basically just joined before before Lehman Brothers went under. And so we said, oh, well, why don't we just, you know, what we've got to lose? Why don't we just try something? And so we started looking for locations and then just absolutely just fell on my feet managing to find this space. So I had no idea how I was going to pay for it. I hadn't even got a business plan at this point. And we managed to open our first gym in Liverpool Street in 2009, which was sort of a good, you know, in the middle of a financial crash, it was probably not the best time to be doing something like that. But then at the same time, I never would have been able to find that space if, you know, people have been looking to take on a new commercial property at the time. So yeah, and we launched that. That was called The Foundry. We ran that for 5 years and then we actually sold that business. I took a year out. I did a lot of some writing, presenting. I worked as a charity I was a trustee for 10 years called School of Hard Knocks that basically uses rugby and sport to help children at risk of exclusion and adults who are out of work. And it uses sport and the power of sport to help people with those outcomes. And so I worked for them for a year. And then I met my business partner then, Ben Gotting, who was a former rugby player, and we decided to basically start working together. We relaunched a boot camp that started doing well, and then sort of kind of rolled again, steamrolled from there, and we ended up with a few gyms. That now is 5 gyms, and the company's called The Foundry, and yeah, it's doing all right. It's yeah, I always sound a bit blasé with these things because, like, you know, I'm kind of trying to summarize, you know, 15 years worth into 30 seconds. But I mean, basically, I spent 15 years just counting to 10 in a gym for people, just counting reps. That's basically okay. What I did.
I think that probably down. I'd imagine that downplays to some point, some extent, what you did in 15 years to grow a business with, you know, 5 premises, and I'm guessing a fairly loyal fan base, and you know, you're now able to enjoy the benefits of that. And as much as I'm itching to sort of dive into that, I appreciate this is not a business podcast. This is a podcast probably about hiking in your life. So I'm going to go more into you, of course, but that's super interesting. Now, somewhere along the line, you then decided to stop working for or stop, you know, being so involved within that and move up north. Now, where did that fit into it? Was that a sort of burnout led decision or just you kind of ticked that box and you just had itchy feet and wanted to do something new?
So this is probably one of the rare occasions there was actually the semblance of a plan. I had always had, I mean, it's a nice segue into the hiking side of things, but obviously I'd spent my childhood and any spare time I ever had hiking and camping and just being outdoors. I've loved it all over the world. I've always been a massive fan of sleeping under the stars and just being outside in nature as much as I can. And when I met my my then girlfriend, now wife, Helen, she'd been busy in the heady world of sort of financial PR before she met me. And I think the last holiday she'd been on with a boyfriend before me, they'd gone to Monaco or somewhere like that. And I think they'd literally been on a yacht. So instead I took a B&B round Ireland in the middle of February. And I always say I knew, this is also how I knew we made it, because I just have this, and it's such a clear memory of us. We were in Galway and we'd been in the pub, and obviously we were several Guinness down, and it had been this fantastic night, Kayleigh bands, you know, the full proper experience. And we were walking back to our B&B and the rain was horizontal. And I just remember we were hiding behind this umbrella like this. And I was looking at her thinking, oh, fucking hell, I've completely, what have I done to this girl? This is not her bag. And I looked over and she was just laughing her head off. And then she always says that was her favorite holiday we've ever had. It just took her completely out of her comfort zone. And what was interesting about that was, you know, I got her hiking up a few hills and she just wasn't silly. I remember in a sheepskin coat, just going, hey, let's go just summit that hill over there. There's a castle at the top. Let's go see what's up there. And she was up there and drenched in rain. And she had like, you know, like Audrey Hepburn. She had just like a random scarf around her head just to keep herself dry. She just wasn't. She wasn't prepared for this at all. But after that, we both got very much into, you know, hiking and weekend camping. And I think our next holiday after that was camping around France. And we sort of said to each other, like, you know, we didn't have a pot to piss in for a good, like, it's this ridiculous situation. And anyone who has ever set up a business themselves, especially if they haven't taken on funding, will sort of know, like, we were in a position where our gym business after a couple of years was turning over seven figures, and we weren't in a position where we could even take, I think we were living on less than £1,000 a month between us. So we were on working tax credits and benefits, and yet we had this business that had employed 20 odd people. And it's just because the margins are so thin, we were still, every penny we had, we were just reinvesting in the business and just trying to get it to grow. And so it was very, very lean. And the idea that we would ever be able to have, you know, somewhere with some land or anything, it just seemed like this ridiculous pipe dream. But
what was it about you and your wife, do you think, that allowed you to hold on to that dream? Because sort of there's a lot of people hold on to the idea of having a bit of land, and, you know, that being the long-term dream, your own land, build a house and whatever you want to do, have your sheep and your chickens. And for you, that's become a reality, which is amazing. What was it about you and your wife, do you think, that allowed you to get from where you were to where you are and see that through?
No, I think that's really, and it's something, it's actually interesting. It's something I want to talk about because people ask me this all the time. And I would have been very naive about this myself 15 years ago, but basically that was the plan. We were like, right, how do we make that a reality? So part of it is just the really boring stuff. We just sacrificed every holiday, saved every penny we could, et cetera, all the really dull, boring stuff. And I wouldn't highly recommend, you know, throwing your 20s and 30s away in order to do that. But that was part of it. The other thing I've realized was initially in my head, it was, you know, I had this kind of like socialist utopia vision of how I could do this and I could, you know, basically just sort some sort of commune out with some friends and it'd all be fine because, you know, everyone has a right to that sort of lifestyle. And then ironically, I would say what actually made it a reality was the business acumen I picked up and all the hard lessons running a business. Because I realized to myself, and this is what most people still don't realize. Everyone thinks, you know, because we have there's a farmhouse. It's called Nethergill Farm up in the Dales. And everyone assumes you get a residential mortgage like anything else, but it's not. We basically have a business loan. So I had to write a business plan and we have to run it as a business. And on that basis, as long as you've got, this is boring, business chat, but as long as you've got an okay credit line, if you can present a good business plan, then someone will give you the money. And that's basically what we did. We were lucky enough, we're in a position where we'd, I suppose, been able to build enough credibility there that we could go to a bank and say, well, here's this business we've seen. You know, we have holiday lets there, so that there was already an income stream, you know, a massively underutilized one, if I'm honest, which we've managed to sort of, you know, triple, which has been very helpful. And we had a plan of how we could actually turn it into a sustainable business, so that then you can kind of do what I think of the more rewarding stuff. You know, I want to work with the charities I'm involved with up there. I love that. Like for us, what's something that was incredibly important, and obviously it's very, I suppose, timely at the moment, is we wanted to find somewhere where we could have 100% public access, which is what we have. So anybody can come to Nethergill Farm. The Dales Way literally runs past our front door. So we have a nature barn there where we have like an honesty box for teas, coffees, homemade flapjacks, and it's brilliant. People just come in and spend hours, and everyone wants to talk to me about hiking. And so we actually have quite high footfall, but the whole of the land there is just available for everybody all the time, as long as, you know, everyone's sensible and doesn't, you know, don't interfere with the livestock and all the rest of it, and close the gates and all the usual stuff everyone moans about.
Yeah, because it's 300 acres, is it? Is
that my thing? It's actually... I sound like a dick saying this now. It's actually 400. But,
Sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
But splitting acres.
I laid that out for you. My apologies.
So now I do sound like a knob.
I feel like I want to say, is it 500 acres?
And no, it's definitely 400.
So you go to say, oh, no, it's
It's basically a 400-acre upland. Yeah. You know, historically, that would have been a sheep farm, because that's kind of the only thing you could do there. But what another passion of us, and I've got to be a little bit, you know, a little bit sensitive on this, is... it's why I tend to talk of like regenerative agriculture rather than rewilding, because I think that phrase means a lot of different things to a lot of people. And it is a working farm. We have a very small herd of native breed belted Galloway that are actually incredibly important for the land and for the ecosystem. And you know what my vision wasn't, you know, it has to pay its bills as well as a place. So what I didn't want to do was just buy this big lump of land and sit there as some weird, you know, estate owner and basically, you know, close the gates. That wasn't what we were looking to do.
I got a question about this then. So two very contrasting lives you've led. Living in London, running a, you know, fast-paced, fast-growing gym chain to running a farm. Now, there's obviously some transferable skills there. And for everybody listening, we will get to the
hype. Are there? Because you should probably tell me what they are.
business loans, marketing, blah, 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 all that stuff. I'm sure it's transferable skills. Was it an initiation of fire running a farm? Because obviously you've had no experience of that, to my knowledge. How did that go?
The experience I had is I'd actually sort of laboured on farms when I was younger, but that's very different to running something. But you know, I'd mucked out. I'd helped at like a sheep shearing season. I'd sort of like helped rugby tackle sheep for people. I'd done a lot of manual labour growing up. That was all my summer jobs. Basically, I wasn't really smart enough to do anything in an office back then, so it was anything physical I could do. And you know, but this is the other thing, is like, and this sounds obviously, I will never have the experience of a stockman with 30 years experience, and I don't need to. So we do work with someone locally on that basis, fantastic farm called Gary, who's just down the road. He lives about 10 kilometers away, but I was literally down the road for our farm. It's like two farms down. But also there's so much support for these kind of things now, and there's, you know, with podcasts, with the internet, with YouTube, like, you literally have all the information of civilization if you know where to look at it. And like I said, and you've got to be careful on that. Like, I am not arrogant enough to know, to think that that means I can just choose a career and follow it. You know, I'll never have that knowledge. And the best thing you can do is listen. And so what I make sure I do up there, I'm not going up there telling, and you know, anyone who's ever been to Yorkshire, let alone the Dales, will know that outsiders, you know, you have to be about sixth generation to actually be considered a local. So there's genuinely, the farmer up the road has been there 30 years and everyone still talks to him as you know, an outsider. So so I listen and I ask people questions, and incredibly, when you ask people sincere questions, they want to help you and give you answers. But at the same time, we want to show willing. And so me and my wife, we've been on a lot of you know, courses, both stock courses, rewilding courses, land management things. I think your background's slightly in that, isn't it? Can I see degree-wise, aren't you? Wasn't it more on the sort of like the countryside?
Oh, side? Have you looked at my LinkedIn?
Of course I have. I've stalked you.
It's done your research. sort of. Countryside management was part of my degree. And outdoor recreation. Being completely honest, it was a bit of a Mickey Mouse degree, and I'm now in marketing for an outdoor brand. So my career is
clearly not.
No, completely unrelated.
No, really?
Yeah, yeah.
So sure. I want to know, what did you do? What did you do for 3 years then?
Was it over 3 years? Well, I lived in Buxton and I climbed and I drank and I scraped through and did what I had to get a reasonable degree, but it wasn't difficult. That's for sure. You're not going to pretend this podcast about me.
That's right. It sounds like a great way to spend 3 years.
It was a fantastic way to spend 3 years. In hindsight, with a brain of 30,
I think the 20, you know, old, the interesting point you raised there about the different lifestyles is, like, you know, humans are incredibly adaptable, and that's something I've just learned the older I get. Right, we all adapt to our environment and our circumstances all the time. And, you know, I'm absolutely not interested in trauma porn, but I've been through, you know, various challenges, and as has everybody else. And the one thing I have learned is that, especially if something isn't working for you, that the only solution really is to change that. So for me, it was very much around, I just realized I'd reached that part of my life. I was completely burnt out. I'm sure we'll talk about, I say, my history of brain injury at some point, and then the sort of physical and psychological trauma that I'd never really had a chance to process it, because I'd just been working so hard for so long and I was totally burnt out. I was self-medicating with alcohol and all the other not so healthy coping strategies that people use, and I just realized I needed to change things. And part of that was also finding somewhere that enabled me just to live life at that sort of pace where I basically didn't really have the choice. Because, you know, I'm one of those people as well who just can't sit still. You know, I can't go do a resort holiday. I have to be doing something all the time. But at least if you're doing something physical that maybe isn't, I mean, you. I don't know if you feel the same, Matthew. I'd be interested, but like, I don't get tired walking all day. I mean, I do. I get physically tired, but it's different. I could walk for 10 hours and I don't feel burnt out. I want to sleep, and but my mind is clear. And whereas I could do a 2 hour, board meeting, and I'm wiped.
Yeah,
I'm wiped for the day. You know, it's such a pretty different similar level of stress and intensity.
Yeah. For me, if I'm working on something that interests me, I can go forever. Like, it's almost like my battery doesn't run out, but as soon as I do something that doesn't interest me, I'm half asleep.
And that's it, and I know I was being facetious earlier about the gym company, but being in the gym, I love coaching people, I love being on the gym floor, I really enjoyed that, and I actually took a lot of energy from that, even if it was a long day. Spending 8 to 10 hours, which is mostly what I was doing, sitting on a laptop looking at spreadsheets, doing sales, marketing, it's just exhausting and draining, and you know as well as I do, it's I don't think it was sustainable.
Yeah. And was there a particular, obviously you were getting to that point where you're feeling like that lifestyle, that sort of fast-paced city lifestyle wasn't working, was there a tipping point in particular, and where does your brain injury fit into that? Because that's a fairly significant part of your story. So I'm curious to know where that slides
into. It is, yeah. I've actually had 4 major brain injuries, all playing rugby in my life. So, yeah. And at really quite sort of seminal points in my life. So one of them was when I was 16, and then I had... And what's been quite both fascinating, but also, I suppose, quite difficult for me is it's only been in the last few years where I've been piecing together the impacts of them, because I was so blasé about them. You know, when I was 16, I was knocked out for over an hour. And it sounds so stupid, but genuinely, that felt fairly normal back then. It didn't feel like a big deal.
Of course, yeah, because you're 16 and you think you're invincible.
I was 16, and it was just, you literally didn't show any weakness on a rugby pitch back then. And there was no concussion protocol or anything like that. So I was unconscious for all this time. I had a seizure on the pitch, and, I was back playing within 2 weeks. And obviously, that's, people listening to this will think that's insane now, but that is what it was like. And I don't condone it, but I still understand why that happened. But unsurprisingly, the bit I've never put together was that out of nowhere, within a few weeks of that, I was suffering from depression after being like a very happy teenager, no mental health problems or anything. All of a sudden, my entire personality changed within
was down to the brain injury and not down to...
Yeah, absolutely. But obviously, but I didn't realize that at the time. There was nothing else that could have got, because all the other symptoms made sense. I was finding it impossible to study in class. I was having mood swings. I was getting, you know, what's difficult is you're a teenager, right? So a lot of this just sounds like being a teenager. But this was overnight. I hadn't been like this, and it was very much instigated by this injury. And then,
had you realised that was the reason at that point, or were you still
not at all. And that was a real struggle for me and my family, because it was very much the and even mental health then wasn't, you know, I was I went to the adult because I just didn't know what these symptoms were, and I was diagnosed with depression, and that's what they said. They said, oh, you have depression. I didn't, you know, to me just depression just meant you were a bit sad or whatever. It wasn't a thing. And I was given antidepressants at 16 years old, which, being really honest, was not helpful. I can understand the rationale, I understand how I got there, but I think so much, and what the one thing I really want to get across in this podcast is that awareness of brain injuries, because even whilst our knowledge and understanding and I suppose awareness of mental health and mental distress has improved dramatically over the 20 years since, you know, that more that happened to me, I would say awareness of brain injury hasn't really. Like, people do talk about it more now, and especially in sport, but that's really been in the last 5 years or so. And you know, it's not that brain injuries can't cause psychological problems, obviously, but we also have to understand that sometimes that is the reason. You know, and it might not be something that's going on in someone's life. It might not be hormonal or whatever. It might be the fact that they actually, you know, have an injury to their brain.
So what was the point? So you said you've had four different injuries.
Yeah. And
what was the point for you where you realized that this was actually, you know, that your brain, you had suffered a brain injury. That, what was that realization?
So it was COVID, really, because.
Okay. Oh, not long ago then.
I knew I'd have brain injuries, and I also knew the symptoms, but I sort of just naively assumed, oh, I'm fine, because.
Yeah. You feel okay. I'm fine.
But I guess I didn't really know what my baseline was as well, because I had a really bad one when I was, where was it, about 2014? And it was bad for a few years. But then, because some of the obvious symptoms just started improving, I just assumed I was fine. But the issue with these things is, I was, throughout all of that, I was doing 60 hours weeks. I had all this responsibility and stress onto all the problems that people have anyway. Obviously compounded by running a business, and then COVID hit. And obviously that was very stressful for everybody. And initially I think I actually responded quite well to it. We adapted our business. We very much converted to the virtual fitness model. And we were doing really, really well. But it was really just coming out of that, I realized the impact that it had on me. And I was just spent. I had nothing to give anybody. I was of no use to anybody, my family, my colleagues. And it was also then where I realized that all those symptoms that I associate with my brain injury were very much still there. So I was suffering major issues with just a simple, the physiological things such as headaches, blurred vision, balance problems, but also personality and mood things. That, like, week to week, sometimes my personality would just flip with no rhyme nor reason. And I suffered a lot from what we call disinhibition, which is very much, and now I understand a bit more about my actual injury, because now I've actually, you know, it sounds silly to have had four brain injuries before actually having a neurology appointment, but that's the situation I was in. So now I've actually obviously seen medical professionals. We understand that, you know, I had frontal lobe trauma, which is important for all sorts of, you know, cognitive appraisal and decision making, and very much for filtering conversations and things. So there was a period there where I was just blurting things out and not really even understanding, like, that could be offensive, or I could or you know, it maybe wasn't even a reflection of how I actually wanted to communicate with somebody. It was which is why I ended up calling my walk Le Jog Unfiltered, because I thought, well, I'm going to kind of embrace that. But then what I did, along with the sort of medical support I had, I then just overhauled my entire life. And I said, well, clearly triggers for me are stress, exhaustion. You know, I had two young kids as well, so I basically hadn't slept for 4 years. these are all things that, as we talk, we were talking offline before, I've got a stinking cold now because of my youngest. So this is the thing, you're always sick, you're always tired, you're trying to run this business, And I just realized, well, my relationships with friends, colleagues, my children, my wife, they're so much more important. And my health, you only get one shot at that stuff. And it's so easy to lose sight of that, especially when you talk about ego, but especially when you're running something that's your baby. It's less about the ego. It's just more, you know, our gym company was, that was my first baby. And the idea of ever ceding control of that or ever taking my foot off the pedal, I couldn't get my head around that. I just had to give it everything all the time and I could never let it go. And so, yeah, but almost overnight, I realized if I don't change something, I was absolutely rock bottom. If I don't change something now, there's no coming back from this. I know how that feels. I know what it's like to be that low. And if I don't do something now, I don't actually think there's an escape route. And so I, you know, and I'm proud of myself for kind of going the way I did, because it's very difficult when you, as you know, you don't tend to be very rational when you're at those very low points. And but I really did, and I basically sort of sat there, and I remember almost like drawing out a mind map of like, well, what do I do here? And I stopped drinking overnight.
What did low look like for you then? What was your, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, if I can speak bluntly, it was suicidal ideation, definitely. I'm just always a little bit aware of, not that I have any shame talking about these things in public. I think I just have to be careful on those, you know, on this subject. Just, I never want to be, you know, talking about it in anything that sounds sort of like a positive way, because, you know, it's a really terrible thing for anybody to be that low. And to have experienced that. And I think what was interesting for me, though, this time was it was almost quite irrational. I very much realized and recognized that's how I felt. I felt suicidal. And I thought, well, you've got two options then, haven't you? Like, very practically, I was like, well, you can either take that choice, or you can do something about this, because you know things will get better. You've been very low before. Things do get better. But also, what are you actually doing to try and change your situation? What are you doing to get better? So part of it was, working with a neurologist and actually looking at this and changing everything from I stopped drinking. I changed my diet like fairly drastically. It sounds really silly when you're running a gym business, but I actually started exercising properly. But for me, finding time and making time to be fit and healthy, and just massively reducing my stress. I have a very specific problem with dopamine function. So dopamine, you probably know, is a neurotransmitter. And I've realized subsequently
is that
one of the problems.
Due to the brain?
It is, yeah, due to the injury. So I don't produce. So the problem with that is I tend to go, like, I'm a bit of a dopamine junkie. So I look for it all the time in those really like crappy little hits. So for me, you know, alcohol, like, you know, little sort of like exciting things, like, you know, even going on roller coasters or whatever, but even beyond that, so like little dopamine hits from social media, from flirting with people, all those kind of things, you know, that like that we kind of recognize, all of us, like most of us do that to a degree, but for me it was literally addictive because I wasn't producing. Whereas now I actually do things and you know, to kind of manage that naturally and holistically, and, you know, a whole lot, like cold water swimming, the lot.
Tell me about that. What do you, because I think in general, sort of, whether anyone has brain injury or say ADHD, which causes dopamine deficiency, what are your kind of biggest tactics to help to manage that kind of?
Yeah, so again, I've got to be careful because, you know, I'm not a medical professional.
But what works for you personally?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me personally, you've got, obviously, you know, your major things, which are sleep, nutrition, and exercise. And I always say to everyone, they're your big rocks, and worry about those before you worry about the little rocks. You know, get those in place. For me, interestingly, nutrition-wise, I actually follow at least the majority of the year, very close to like a ketogenic diet, because there's an awful lot of evidence. And I actually work with this with one of my psychology supervisors who sort of specializes in researching this area. But there's a lot of work being done on the ketogenic diet and cognition, basically brain function for treating brain injuries and in condition neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. And that has been fairly transformative to me. It's actually been remarkable how much that improved my cognition, my awareness, my concentration, and fairly quickly as well, which was really interesting. There's a few supplements I use as well, which again I probably won't mention here just because I don't want anyone to take those as like advice. But again, if you get on, what I would highly recommend is getting on like examine.com, which is extremely reputable website for actually looking at the data on these things. There are several cognitive enhancer nootropics, as they're known, which are all legal and which can make quite a big difference. I'll just throw one out, but things like lion's mane, which is a mushroom, which again is fairly well established as having an impact on cognitive function. And then the other thing for me is being outside, and whether that's just getting outside or doing something more dramatic like walking from Land's End to John O'Groats, that is honestly the most transformative thing for me. I'm such a huge believer in walking, I think, and it's something I'm sort of studying at the research level now. I'm finishing off my psychology master's at the moment, and I truly think walking has, you know, almost sort of magical properties. There's something so interesting about doing, it's a physical activity, but it's kind of the bare minimum of physicality. But you've got also this experience of moving through vistas. So your visual fields are changing, your experiences are changing, all your sensations are changing as you're moving. You have a really clear goal in mind because you're going from A to B most of the time, unless you're just sort of rambling. It's what I found on the, I'm sorry to talk about hiking on your podcast, by the way, but it's what I found.
No, you've just taken my segue into hiking and just nailed the position of it.
The thing I always found was every day you talk about those little dopamine hits, but for me, it was knowing, right, today I need to be at B, I set off from A, and, you know, whether I ever quite made it there or not, but wherever I needed to be, I would walk to that location. And it was a sense of achievement. It was literally like a victory every single day that I have achieved something, even though in the grand, let's be honest, if you want to get philosophical about it, everything's pointless. But like,
yeah,
in the grand scheme of what, felt productive in the sense of society,
hiking is not.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hiking is not productive. And it's a real privilege to be able to do it. And I'm very aware it's a privileged experience. Yeah. But it felt incredibly productive. And so I felt like I had these major achievements on a daily basis, in addition to all the little achievements on the walk. You know, every time you reach a new thing, every time you saw something fantastic, every time you took a picture that took your breath away. And one of the other real lessons I've taken from it, and something I actually want to kind of take into my, I suppose, professional life and personal life going forward, is most of two lessons actually. The first one is, I consciously didn't take headphones with me. And so I didn't listen to music or podcasts or anything. And honestly, that was fucking awful for the first 2 weeks.
That must have been hard at the beginning.
Beyond hard. I've never been more uncomfortable than just being alone with my own thoughts for 8 to 10 hours a day of walking. And then something really magical happened around that sort of 2 week period where all of a sudden it started feeling a bit more comfortable. And then by the end, it just felt completely normal. And I would just be inside. And all these thoughts that go through your head, I came up with whole business ideas. I wrote book chapters. I came up with songs and poems. But all these things that you realize you just don't have, you do not have the time, the space, the capacity to do that in your day-to-day life. And that was incredible. And then the other lesson I was going to say was when I was then with other people. So I was very fortunate that lots of people would join me for this walk, you know, just for a day here and there. This is aside from, I did a lot of it with my daughter, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But so someone would just join me for a day. And I use the example of a lady, Kate, who I went to university with, who I studied with for 3 years with and knew. And, you know, we got on well, but we weren't like best mates or anything. And then I genuinely got to know more about her in 4 hours hiking together than I did in 3 years studying with her. It was incredible how much we both opened up. And subsequently, then I've actually really delved into the research on this. And there's a lot of research on this that shows that walking with someone, you've got this interesting thing of a shared experience and you're doing something physical, but also like you haven't got eye contact, which is really interesting. Like it's intimate, but it's not
intense.
Same direction. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so naturally people tend, and I found that every single person who joined me told me something very intimate, you know, very personal, shared their story. And that was a real privilege. And I haven't recreated that in any other, you don't get it over coffee dates. You don't get it, you know, when people come and have a glass of wine or whatever. It's something really unique to walking together that I find utterly fascinating. And I genuinely think everyone should experience that.
So I'm going to rewind you just a little bit. So this was your Land's End John O'Groats walk. Is that correct? So, yeah. And this was the unfiltered walk. Now, can I just start, go from the beginning of that walk? This was the walk that you did to raise money for Headway UK. Yeah? Okay. What was the point where you decided that you wanted to do this? Because there's a million different challenges you could do. There's also, you know, you could have bungee jumped, you could have skydived, you could have cycled across the world. You could, you know, well, maybe not with kids and stuff and time allowing, but there's a ton of stuff you could have done. Was it long distance hiking something you'd done previously and wanted to?
Sorry to cut you off. I'd never done a through hike that long. Done a couple of days, I've done a week, but then I suppose in my head I was like, well, if I can do a couple of days, just keep doing that. Or if I can do a day hike, it's just lots of day hikes. I am a big fan of the you know, fail to prepare to fail sort of philosophy. But then at the same time, it's a bit like with when we first set up our gym company, me and my wife. Like, I also think sometimes you can overthink these things. So whilst I had done some prep in the sense of I'd read, you know, a few end-to-end books, I had watched a few videos on YouTube, I'd sort of thought about how it would be, how I'd get my daughter involved, these kind of questions. I'd been thinking about that for sort of 6 months, and then it coincided with, so this is kind of March, April last year, when I was absolutely at my lowest, and I just realized I needed to do something that also had a, you know, maybe a slightly sort of metaphorical angle for me as well, you know, an actual journey. So not just a mental journey, an actual physical journey that hopefully, you know, I could kind of undertake, had an arduous element to it that would build some resilience within me as well. And, you know, and that's obviously a theme that's run through millennia, you know, that the sort of taking that, finding yourself on a quest kind of thing. But, and there was something really appealing about that.
And it's very romantic, well, as an idea.
It, of course it is. And, but then I also thought, oh, I love hiking. I love, you know, and it was, and there was a very specific thing which brings my daughter into it, which is that during lockdown, and well, it started in lockdown, obviously we were only allowed outside for our 1 hour a day, and so we used to go for walking as a family, and then if it wasn't as a family, I used to go walking with my daughter before my son was born, and that was our thing, and it just sort of became, and then it stayed our thing. So I used to walk her to nursery every day. Even now I walk a kilometer to school every day and back, and it just sort of became our thing. It was when we, and it's really interesting because as she's grown and she, you know, she's a beautiful little girl, and her personality is changing, where before it was all very fun, and I was just thinking the other day, like, now sometimes we just walk in silence now, but it's really still lovely in a way that I definitely have a bond with her when we're walking that, you know, we actually probably don't share in any other aspect of this, or when she's getting grumpy about things, but something really magical happens when we're off walking together. And so this was a genuine conversation I had when, I will be very honest with you, and I was just crying on the sofa and I was just feeling pretty shit. And she, bless her, you know, she was whatever, 3 years old at the time. And she said, "What's wrong, Daddy?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just feeling very sad." And she said, "Well, what makes you happy?" And I said, I've wheeled off a load of things. And I said, "You know, I'm going for a walk with you." And she said, "Well, why don't we go for a walk then?" And then it just sort of, Yeah, I know. Obviously, you know, his room suddenly got a little bit dusty, but that was the line, and that was where the sort of seed of an idea was. I was like, well, if I do this, how can I get her involved? And I asked her really honestly, like, I'm one way where I do not have ego is like I'm not a competitive dad. I was very aware I didn't want my daughter to try and be the youngest person to walk the length of Britain or anything like that, just because like, but I thought to myself, would she enjoy this? That was the main thing, and I thought, well, she'd probably enjoy parts of it and not. And not others. Is that something I can deal with? And so we trialed a few hikes together. You know, she was pretty happy walking sort of 5 miles a day. You know, she's a very active little kid and she wasn't getting bored at that. And then, you know, she's relatively slight as well. And I found I could very easily throw her in my Osprey pack and knock out another 10 miles with her. It was actually quite comfortable even at 3 years old. You know, I'm going to say one thing. I was reasonably fit then. Like I had actually built up. I was doing a lot of running, and so I'd done a bit of fitness before this. But then when it actually came, you said, you know, then what happened? Honestly, I had my university exams in. And I can't even remember. Do you know, I've actually lost track of the dates now. But let's say June, and basically my wife had to go to New York for work, and I realized there was a window that if I didn't start the following week, I wouldn't be able to do it. And so I genuinely packed my bag there and then, and we all drove down to Cornwall together and I started, and that was it. And I hadn't even announced to anyone I was doing it. I hadn't set up a fundraising page. It was the best way to do it. Cause I remember that first day, and we did that it was actually three of us because my son was with his grandparents at the time. But the three of us actually did that first walk on the Southwest Coastal Path. And it was a gorgeous walk. It was hard. And it was this thing, we ended up doing nearly 20 kilometers on day one, up and down about 1,000 meters of elevation. And I remember thinking, what the fuck have I signed up to? Like, I genuinely do not know how I'm going to do this. And in a way, it's quite, and I know a few people have done that. Obviously, it's actually quite a baptism of fire doing that route. But it was also quite useful because I was like, well, I kind of can't quit now. I've just committed to this. I've literally just turned up, started, and told everyone I'm doing it. So,
and how much of that walk did Willow do with you?
So, I do you know, off the top of my head, I can't remember the exact, it was over 500 miles. It was something like 512 miles of a and what was a real so I did 1234 miles, which is obviously an incredibly serendipitous, lovely, poetic number, 1234, but that's literally what it was as we arrived. And she did, yeah, over 500, but obviously I always stress people, like, I was carrying her plenty, like I don't pretend otherwise. But it was one of those things, what we tended to do, I'd like carry her for a couple of kilometers and she'd walk for a couple, then I'd carry her for a couple. And in the end, the way it worked out was she joined me for a week of like every section, basically. So in the Southwest, through the Midlands, through Yorkshire, and then sort of Norfolk. And then some of the bits where also I just didn't feel it was appropriate. And, you know, so the Pennine Way, I honestly just didn't really want to have a three-year-old as it was there with me, and it was pretty rubbish weather for that bit. And then she was going to do a little bit longer, but then I don't know if you remember last year when we had the heat wave, I was actually coming up through your way. So I was going through Ashbourne. So I literally gone through the Tissington Trail through the Peak District, and she was supposed to be with me for that. And we just made the call. We looked at the forecast and it was going to be 40 degrees. And I was
it's just not
a good idea. Yeah. So yeah, she didn't join me for that. And then what we did for the very last week up the John O'Groats Trail, my wife and my son came up, we got a camper van and they basically followed us up. So we did the walk for a week and they joined whenever they could. And that was amazing. So we just like camped in the camper van every night. Basically just wild camped it on the way up on the coast, and it was brilliant.
That sounds fantastic, and it must have been a really incredible way to sort of have just kind of strengthen that bond further with Willow.
Absolutely, and it's something I always feel a bit sorry for my son, and he's still just a little bit too young, but it, as I said to you before, it really has built something very special that's kind of hours. And I don't, you know, I hope that doesn't sound selfish, but it is quite nice as a parent to have something quite unique that you have with your kids. I don't know if you find that as well. I don't know, maybe I feel a bit guilty saying that, but
no, not at all. No, me and my young lad have things that are just ours for now, while he's got a brother who, you know, doesn't do the same things, aren't interested in them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it's just like that. It's just we have this shared interest in in walking together, and yeah, and it obviously hugely deepened that bond. And I got to see her. I mean, this was the lovely thing. It was over the summer holiday. It was obviously also the only time in her life. I knew she was starting school that September. I was like, well, you know, she's never gonna have the opportunity to do something like this over a couple of months in the summer. And I mean, yeah, that said, I have got plans, but they won't obviously be quite as quite as long as that. And it was also the first time in my entire life where I'd had 60 days where I could do something like that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. And did it challenge your perceived limitations of what a little person can do? Or did you already kind of know what she could manage before?
I think, that's actually a really good question, Matthew. I was quite surprised how, and people were super supportive with us and with her because I think they knew we were being very sensible. But I remember seeing other stories of, you know, very young children doing long through hikes with parents. And I was quite surprised they sometimes get a bit of heat, especially over in the States. And I suppose there's a few more risk factors over there. There was far less bears walking through Wolverhampton. So I was just curious, and I once put a tracker on Willow when she went to nursery, and she clocked about 5 miles.
Oh, wow.
And in a day at nursery, just running around.
That's not surprising, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the thing, you know, say as a parent, it's not surprising, is it? So I was of the opinion, and it's a bit like when people roll their eyes at me and when we talk about like weightlifting with kids, like I'm a huge proponent of children learning to lift weights properly. And they'll say things, but what about their, you know, what about their development? What about, I'm like, which do you think is safer? Like watching a child holding a small weight, learning to do a squat, for example, which is a completely normal movement under a little bit of load, or watching them climb in a tree, jumping out from 2 meters like they do, or like, you know, swinging from a climbing frame, or all the other stupid things kids do all the time that are significantly more risky, but we have no issue about that. We don't think, like, they carry loads all the time, children. They pick each other up. They carry their toys. They, you know, these things aren't inherently dangerous. Teaching a child to lift weight safely is actually incredibly safe.
Yeah, very controlled.
Yeah, controlled sort of experience. And I think I felt like that with the walking. I said all along, if she didn't like it, she could stop. And the worst case was always, I always knew I could carry her, and that was important. And if she got bored, we stopped, or we went and, you know, especially if it was somewhere. I noticed she always tended to get a bit bored when there was somewhere that sold ice cream. So yeah. we had a lot of ice cream breaks.
Fair enough. Yeah, but was it a good way to motivate?
I think it did, though. Do you know what? I'll tell you what it did, though. I think it made me realise that if you can keep their attention, I think I was more worried about her attention span than anything else. And I realised if you make things fun, and if you don't bully kids, and if you don't kind of boss them around, then, yeah, it's amazing how much they're willing to actually put up with and to put in.
Yeah, yeah. So I find whenever I take my son out walking, it's about that constant kind of motivation. You know, if he's flagging at the end of the day, it's right, let's get to that bit and we'll have a little stop or we'll do this thing.
And I imagine those motivations are a little bit different because your children are a little bit older, right?
A little bit, so, yeah.
So, yeah, so what sure. do you tend to use? Like what is that just
verbal motivation? My tactic is a bag of sweets. So I
I was assuming it was different, but that's basically mine. We had I had a bag of Smarties worked. And I told her they were speed pills to make her go faster.
Yeah, exactly. Similar kind of thing to what I do, but also when my eldest was 4, we did penny fan in South Wales. It was really, we just decided one day, it was a nice day, it was New Year's Day, and I was like, I want to go climb a mountain, I want to climb Big Hill. And I was like, I'm going to take Noah with me. So we just got up and did it, just without any planning. And we got to the sort of the false summit, because there's a bit that looks like it's the top, but it's not the top. And I didn't have a map with me because I know it's a path straight up, straight down. So I just followed that. And then we got there and I was like convincing him the whole way up, there's a dragon. We'll see that we might see the dragon if we're lucky, because there was a cloud inversion as well. And we got to the top and he was so excited for the dragon and we were looking around and I was like, shit, I'll convince him there's a dragon. There's going to be no dragon. So I had to make up a story as to why the dragon wasn't there, but the dragon got him to the top. and then combined with, you know, sweets as well, and just that kind of make believe that play, turn it into a fantasy for him. That really worked, kind of motivate him along and get that.
No, and I love hearing that because yeah, that's my experience as well. And like you say, that I'm sure there's people listening who still think that's you know, incredible that you've got a 4-year-old to walk up a, you know, a summit like that. But this is the thing, like, they can definitely do it.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, and he ran back down. Like, he surprised me. We got to the top and he said I've had enough now. I was like, okay, right, we've got to walk back down. And he goes, oh, it's going to take too long. I said, we can run back down. And he goes, okay. So he just literally shot off. Like, and I was, for the whole way down, I was thinking, he's going to fall over. And he didn't. And I was just there jogging behind him. I thought, this is mad. But yeah, it's great fun.
And it's like anything with kids. If you give them a little bit of like independence and responsibility with it as well, then they get very excited by that. I remember we were walking the Dales Way and a couple of friends had joined me on different days. And they were just blown away by her. And one of the things I thought was hilarious was, because obviously I'd explain to her about crossing stiles or kissing gates or whatever. So she would lecture them every time we got to a kiss. She was like, okay, so this is how you cross a stile. And they had to have this little lecture each time of how to do it. And but she loved that, right? Because it made her feel like a, you know, like a big kid.
Like a guide. Yeah, like a guide. I love that. So during this walk, sorry, and then I guess afterwards, was there any kind of noticeable kind of transformation you personally experienced through it? Any change? Because obviously it came at a time in your life where you were struggling with your mental health, and how did you therefore feel when you kind of came out the other side of that?
It's so, I really don't want to be flippant about this, and I'm genuinely saying this from the bottom of my heart with total transparency and honesty, it was the most transformative experience of my entire life. I genuinely came out of it a different person.
What does that look like?
And I put it down to, well, it's hard, isn't it? Like, I honestly think one of the things for me was one of the big issues from my brain injury and the symptoms, like I said to you before, was that I hadn't really ever had the time to heal or to process both physically and psychologically. So what felt normal to me, for example, like, you know, just dropping in and out of conversations because I was too busy and I was running around and I was speaking at 1,000 miles an hour and all the rest of it, that felt normal at the time. And it was only when I really had the quiet and the time and the solitude and the opportunity to just meet random people and have a conversation with them for no other reason than I just enjoyed the sociable interaction. And I'm sure you've experienced, I'm sure lots of people, it's almost like you have a little sign on your back when you're on the trail and you're doing something like this. Because, I mean, I literally did have a sign, but it's more like even when I'd go to get, everybody would sort of gravitate to you a little bit and want to ask questions. And I found that really interesting. Even if I hadn't seen, you know, my actual sign, I think it was just something about you look like you've been on the road for quite a while, right? Hiker trash. So I ended up having wonderful conversations with people where I would just be, you know, just listening to them as well for 10 minutes without saying anything. And so it changed quite a lot of really obvious things, like in the way that I communicate with people. And then the big thing was the solitude and the time to think and to process things. And I said to people, it was like years worth of therapy in 60 days. Just have it. When do you have the time to think and do nothing but think and walk for 10 hours a day? Like, you just don't. It's a huge privilege to have done this. And I realized, but I'm also really, it's the one thing I'm super selfish on. Like, the alternative was a lot worse. So, and I appreciate most people won't have the opportunity or the time or the money or the ability to do something like this. But I genuinely think you can get some of the benefits and possibly all of the benefits from a significantly less, you know, time intensive experience. But I do think you're missing something. Just those little things. So, for example, not listening to music or podcasts while you're doing it. Just be totally present in the moment of what you're doing, and it won't feel comfortable initially. And I do it now when I'm running. So now I still don't listen to beats when I'm running. I run in silence. And it's interesting because sometimes I actually see an impact on my performance. Like, I do run better with music, if that's my goal. But then psychologically, I feel better if I haven't been listening to music because I care far less about the performance and I'm actually just doing it, you know, in just to be in the moment. So yeah, I mean, and everyone has commented, everyone keeps telling me, my friends, my family, everyone's like, you're so much calmer, you're so much more relaxed you seem. One of the big things, which I suppose is mental health related, was I developed, and it was quite late in the sort of brain injury. It wasn't an issue or a symptom initially, and it sort of developed and became really bad. I had absolutely chronic anxiety. And this was because I was someone who had, I'd stand up on stage and speak to hundreds of people, and you know, and I was teaching classes, and this had never been an issue. I've never had a problem with anxiety. And it just sort of crept up on me and then became debilitating. And that has totally gone. I was really fortunate and really grateful to be invited to do like a 15-minute Q&A at the Headway Annual Awards in Christmas. And there was like 600 people in the room. And I said to my wife, she was like, oh, you know, I got really lovely feedback afterwards and talking about this experience. And my wife said to me, I said, God, were you nervous at all? And I said, genuinely, I didn't have a butterfly. There's nothing. I think as well, because I'm really passionate about this now. And as you said, when you enjoy something, it doesn't become a chore. And so because of that, I think the anxiety, all the sort of associated psychological fallout just sort of disappears because you're doing something you enjoy and you feel confident about. And it's weird because I still feel a bit of an imposter on it. I would never claim to be, you know, an expert outdoorsman, hiker. But then at the same time, I think sometimes, yeah, maybe I'm doing myself a bit of a disservice there, because I think when I do talk to people, so on the West Highland Way, I don't know if you've ever, have you been there?
No, I've not walked in.
Obviously, brilliant experience. And obviously, I think one of the most popular routes in Europe. And so because of that, it was probably the busiest section of my entire route, but I absolutely loved it. I was meeting people from all over the world, but I was definitely one of the eldest by quite a way. Most people were in their 20s. They were all quite sort of fit and healthy. But what really surprised me was how green they were. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. So little things, like it's such a great experience there to have the full experience of being able to light a campfire and being able to actually wild camp. And I remember on my first night, I was with a group of maybe 4 or 5, 20-something. It was wonderfully wholesome kids. Absolutely not the sort of thing I would have been doing at their age, and I love it. But they literally didn't know how to start a campfire. And it was really nice to sort of feel almost like the dad of the group.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, get it started, like, and yeah.
Yeah. Just hear that, you know, but it was lovely as well. I wouldn't hang out with 20-year-olds in my day-to-day life. Just, you know, not through any prejudice, just, you know, you don't, it's not, you know, I'm just an old fart now.
20-year-olds,
it was really nice therefore to kind of, yeah, they don't want to hang around with old people like me. So it was just really nice to actually be in that scenario where people did kind of want to hang out with you, but also where you just had a chance to listen to them. And for me, it's the stories on the road as well, in the trail, and then there is just that physical thing. So, you know, actually on a really blunt note, how else did it transform you? Like, I mean, I said to, there's a friend of mine, Pete, if he's listening, we went to school together, and he's also like a sports scientist. And he kept messaging me every day saying, oh, can you send me all your, like, can you send me your data? I want to see your sleep data. I want to see your heart rate. I want to see, and I'm quite a sort of tech nerd on wearables. So I did have, you know, I had my Garmin with me, and I was tracking all that stuff. And it was really interesting, because his theory, I was living the most sort of evolutionary adaptive kind of perfect lifestyle you could, just like what walking all day.
Yeah. Eating, what did the data look like then?
It was genuinely fascinating. So like my HRV, which is your heart rate variability, which is sort of a measure of stress. It improved dramatically. That was, and my sleep scores were so much better. I mean, again, you could argue I was away from my kids, so there's probably an element
of
that. But I do put a lot of it down to the sleeping outside and the fresh air and just carrying, and you know, and like just the weight loading. I mean, I traveled light. You know, I sort of didn't have a huge amounts of weight on me at any point really. But even still, like, you know, and I got quite competitive with the distances, which is probably not something I'd recommend to you, but it worked for me. I quite like knocking out some quite big days. And
If you can do it and you feel comfortable with it, it does feel good to have big days.
It does feel good. Like one day I did 50K just because I wanted to do it. I just wanted to see what it felt like to walk 50 kilometers.
How did it feel?
So on the day, it felt amazing. The next day, I genuinely got out of my tent and fell on my face. Like, oh, really? I remember I tried to take a step and my legs just, they just weren't there. And I just went flat down on my face, arse over to it. And it did feel good. So like physically, I was, unfortunately, I feel like I've undone some of that hard work since. But you know, I don't think you really can beat being in the fresh air, you know, generally eating a lot less. Just, I mean, I was eating as much as I could, but obviously it's just the reality of being on the road. There's never enough food. You know, I think I worked out I needed, like, at one point I was doing about 6,000 calories a day, and I was really struggling to get that in, you know. So, yeah, it was physically, mentally. I look at that, and you can see the smart, well, you can see it, but, like, you know, I'm beaming talking about it, revisiting it. It's, you know, I'm sure most people listening to this, and I guess I really want to, I'm fascinated, and I love what you're doing. And I think what people who are doing what you're doing are doing a massive service to everyone, because the number of times our people go, oh, that sounds incredible, I'd love to get into that, I just don't know how, I'm terrified of the idea about hiking. And it's something I really want to keep sharing with people and just show them, like I say, even if it's just a weekend, even if it's just a post-pub lunch stroll or whatever, but just, you know, we live these lives now where we're just locked in concrete all day long, and there really is so much more.
So what and how are you going to share this with people going forward? What are your plans for hiking this year and beyond?
So I have got a little bit of a thing in the works, but I am going to keep it to myself for now, just okay. Because it's...
Give us it. I'm going to squeeze
it. Well, I want to do it with Willa, but... Sorry, go on.
Does it involve hiking, or is it...
It does. No, it would be another similar... But we don't have quite as much time, but it would be... I love the... I don't know why... I don't actually know. I've been thinking what the motivation is, but I really enjoy the idea of just walking across countries specifically. Like, I loved... And so I have looked at other places we could do this summer. And then the idea of every summer just, you know, complete another one. And I think I sort of prefer that, maybe even to, like, specific, you know, ticking off long distance routes. I think the other thing is, once you've done Le Jog, like, I obviously experienced a lot of those anyway, you know, the Pennine Way, the Dales Way, and the West Highland Way, and the, you know, the Southwest Coastal Path. So, you know, again, I could go walk the entire Southwest Coastal Path, but I don't know if that would give me what I'm looking for.
You want to look at something completely fresh and new then, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's that. And again, so yeah, talking to Willow, we were sort of saying, we're looking at a summer holiday. I have a very understanding wife. I should stress, I make up for it. I do most of the childcare, like, in our normal lives, day to day. And so my kind of thing is, like, can I wangle a month every summer where I have a very understanding wife?
It's all about compromise, isn't it? It's all about compromise.
Exactly. Yeah. But then also with that, so up at the farm, the big thing we want to do is, you know, we already have loads of walkers visiting us all the time, but my longer term plans on a personal note are to continue with my psychology studies and actually complete a doctorate and actually be able to combine walking with therapy, but with the physical side of things as well.
Yeah.
Well, I have this whole vision of, like, walking therapy, so, I think, is the... Yeah,
my,
go for it.
My partner is a therapist herself and has just finished her NHS job to work for herself. And also she works for a company in Galway. Doing therapy as well. So familiar with that world. So I was going to ask you, with your psychology degree, obviously you must be looking at using that in a sort of professional way. How would that look then, in terms of combining, because there's obviously some elements in your life here which very nicely intersect. And I think the impression I've got from talking to you is some of that's by design, some of that's kind of perhaps by accident, but, you know, you've got your appreciation and passion behind kind of mental health and brain injury. You've got your appreciation of fitness. You live in a beautiful landscape, which has kind of free and abundant access to the outdoors, and you love long distance hiking. I can see all of that kind of coming together. How do you?
That's it.
What's your vision? What's your vision for that?
I mean, you basically just shared my vision. So, but it is kind of bringing together the tenets of, I suppose, nature, green exercise, and therapy, and however you want to kind of call therapy, because there's lots of different types. An area I'm genuinely fascinated in, and I've just completed a research project on, is psychoneuroimmunology, which your partner will probably know quite a lot about. But the
mind body connection, and
but just the way it's genuinely fascinating, the way that our minds affect our immune system, which affects health outcomes. And you know, that's again where the idea of stimulating a bit of acute stress with things like exercise, hiking, cold, you know, wild swimming, cold water, those kind of things. Like, there's a lot of really good science backing that up. But then you also need that you know, slightly more therapeutic, recuperative side of things as well. And yeah, that would absolutely be my dream. I think I would love to run retreats up at Nethergill. We're in the process of, so we're basically waiting for planning permission to build some more accommodation and build a gym and a teaching space. So I would love to be able to run retreats there, which would, and I'm going to be really honest, because this is how I, you sort of asked me about how I ended up in the farm. The other thing I realized from the reality of the capitalist sort of society we live in is that the best way to support, to do social good in the world we live in, I find, is actually to have a successful business that you can basically funnel into doing that. So that's what we did with our gym company. We have a charity arm to it, and we offer subsidized or free training to people who can't afford it. And this is basically what I want to do up at the farm. I want to run retreats for all these stressed out executives I know who want to come up and stay in the Dales for a week and, you know, pay for the privilege of doing it. And I'll be really transparent about that. And then use that to work with the charity partners I know, look at rehab retreats, look at the stuff that I suppose actually, you know, I'm not a martyr or a saint by any means, but, you know, we all need to feel like we're making a difference. And I find that I have quite an acute need to do that, which is probably actually very selfish, but it makes me feel happy to do that.
It's entirely reasonable to be selfish in life. I like the idea of happy executives equals happy employees. So
you'd hope so. That's the idea. But you're right. It's like, you know, I want to get back. I like the idea of coaching people there, but combining these other elements as well. So you have to tell me all about your partner's therapy after off air.
For sure. Yeah, 100%. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap it up. So where can people find you online and kind of learn a bit more about you and what you're up to?
So you can find me on social media, on the usual things. If you look Dave Unfiltered, I'm not super active at the moment. I have to be honest. I've just had my head down in exams for the last couple of months. So I've been really trying hard not to to get too distracted. But yeah, I'm sure we can whack it in the show notes there. And I'm always open to connecting, to having conversations. And obviously, big thing for me is if you've suffered from brain injuries or any mental distress, I have a lot of personal experience, but also, you know, quite a bit of professional experience to help at least provide, you know, a bit of guidance and hopefully signpost some good support to people as well. You know, you never have to suffer in silence on these things.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, well, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Really appreciated your transparency and honesty about your story. So thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much, Matthew. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure. Take care.